I am your host, Juliet.
And I am your co-host, Teresa.
And you're listening to Mind the Gap. Mind the Gap is a podcast dedicated to discovering the minds behind the people bringing science to society. From challenges to opportunities, we uncover the impact of research on policy, community, and ultimately, you. So sit back, relax, and please, mind the gap.
Today we are here with Juliet Rowe to chat about her experience at a recent workshop, ComSciCon Canada.
Hello!
Juliet, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I was waiting for the time that I would get this question. I think after all of the podcast episodes we've done by now, you probably know a little bit about me because I do include a lot of different little pieces of information. But yes, my name is Juliet, and I'm a current master's student at Dalhousie University, studying under Dr. Sean Bowe. And some cool facts about me, I have three brothers, so I'm one of four kids, and I was raised vegetarian, so I've never tried meat before. I'm an avid lover of cats, not the musical, sorry, but
that would be confusing.
But growing up, I had a really cool cat named Dash, and he was he did not know how to dash. He was quite chonky. He had orange fur and was really cute. And then in my undergrad, I did my undergrad at the University of Victoria. I had another cat named Vivi, which was short for Vivaldi, the composer, and she was a dilute calico, so she was really feisty.
Yeah.
And now I am obsessed with my roommate's cat, Frank, who's a Nebelung, and he's come up a few times, but if you've never searched up Nebelungs, you should. They're really cute.
They are. So, he has a great coat. Great fur coat.
He does. He's kind of a lion right now because his owners shaved him, but he gets like really long gray fur. It's so cute.
I didn't know that you had cats before because I hear so much about Frank. I never knew that you grew up with cats or that you even recently had a cat when you did your undergrad.
Yeah, no, depending on what phase of my life you have met me in, I will have been obsessed with a
different cat, but right now, it has been a cat.
It has been, yeah. Because when I was growing up, like, everyone knew about my cat, Dash. Like, he was just kind of, like, everything that I talked about. And then same in my undergrad. Like, it's just, like, frequent photos of my cat all the time. But, yeah, it's always whatever cat is, like, immediately in front of me.
Yeah.
It's the one that I talk about extensively.
So we'll have to see what happens when Frank moves out.
So Frank's moving out. He was supposed to leave on Saturday, but now he's leaving in a week's time. And, I mean, I'm devastated. Frank is the highlight of every day. But my future roommates are getting another cat, so I will hopefully only be without a cat for like 1 or 2 months.
Wow, I'm excited to know this new cat.
I know. I'm already curious what it's going to be named, what kind of personality it's going to have.
Is it
going to
be a kitten?
I think it is. Oh, fine. And I've never had a kitten. We've always adopted adult cats.
Yeah.
So not that Frank is adopted, but you know.
Yeah. And not that he belongs to you, as you say, we.
Exactly. So yeah, he's not a part of that. But yeah, I think that's all that I typically share about myself. Yeah. I don't know. There's a bunch of other random little facts, but you'll have to listen back to find out that. So next we have our Would You Rather segment, Research Question Edition. Woohoo. So I have two research questions that I am going to ask you to choose between.
Okay.
And these are actually research questions done by students that I met at ComSciCon Canada 2023. Okay. So really exciting stuff. So, Teresa, would you rather study something related to making human brains to tackle glioblastoma, which is an aggressive brain tumor, or use music to tackle sensitivity to sound?
Ooh, those are both very fascinating areas of research.
Yes.
I'm leaning more towards, I would say, using music to tackle sensitivity to sound, just because it's further away from my research involving brains. And obviously, I am not making human brains. So that's pretty far away from my research, too. But between the two of them, I'd say music sensitivity, using music to tackle sensitivity to sound is farthest. So I chose that one.
Okay. Well, you know what? Either way, you're going to learn about both projects.
And either way, they are not up for grabs.
Exactly. They're already taken, unfortunately. But so the topic of using music to tackle sensitivity to sound, I have a paragraph kindly written by one of my friends I've made who said, "We all encounter annoying sounds from time to time, like someone chewing loudly or clicking a pen. And for most of us, this is just a mild irritation. But for some people, these sounds can trigger intense negative emotions, causing significant distress and discomfort. This condition is known as misophonia. And so those with misophonia often try to avoid situations where these trigger sounds might happen, but this can impact their well-being, education, and social relationships, especially in social settings where sounds are a lot more common." Mm-hmm. So, research on misophonia suggests that the reactions it triggers might have more to do with how our brains process sound rather than the acoustic properties of sounds themselves. So, in their work, they try to understand exactly what happens in the brains of people with misophonia when they hear these trigger sounds and ways to help reduce these intense responses. So, to do this, they are going to focus on music. So they're conducting studies where participants are presented with different sounds in each ear, music in one ear and either a trigger or neutral sounds in the other, and participants are asked to pay attention to one ear's sound at a time, either the trigger sound or the music. And so they've already made some progress by assessing emotional reactions through measures like pupil size, skin conductance, and heart rate. And now they're turning to neuroimaging.
Wow. So it is a little related.
I know. You can't get away from neuroscience to understand which parts of the brain are responsible for these responses. So ultimately, they're trying to understand misophonia and discover ways to help people affected by it.
Wow, that is very interesting research. And I feel like that's interesting, the cross-section between misophonia and then using, because if you think about it, this condition is you want to avoid sound triggers that release that trigger negative emotions and cause significant distress and discomfort. And then using music, you would think it's almost like counterintuitive, but I guess like the music would actually be calming or pleasant, whatever the sound is. It obviously wouldn't be triggering. And it's just so interesting how you can use a very similar avenue to combat something like that.
Yeah, I think it's also cool that they've been able to distinguish that it's a brain process and not anything about the properties of sound, which is probably why music being interpreted in our brain differently to things like loud honking sounds on the street, which I have a personal dislike towards. So for anyone interested in looking more into this research, this is a student named Marie Anik, who is a PhD student in psychology at Concordia University. So I'm sure if you give her a little Google search, misophonia and Marie Anik, hopefully something will show up. And their research is very, very interesting. And I would encourage you to seek it out a little bit more. But on the other side,
yes.
The human brains. So this is a student, Jessica Gosio, who's a PhD student at the University of Toronto, and they are doing research related to glioblastomas, which is a aggressive brain tumor. So it's actually the most studied brain tumor because it desperately needs a better treatment. But there has been no new treatments in over 20 years. So how do you study this cancer when it's already been so widely studied? So what Jessica decided to study is something that's never been done before. It's not in a dish. It doesn't have to look at animal models, but it looks at human-like tissues. So she uses stem cells to grow mini human brain-like structures in a dish, and they grow similarly to how the human brain grows, which, in my opinion, could you imagine watching a human brain grow?
That's
crazy.
Crazy.
And just acknowledging that the human brain is so different from other animals, so the best way to study this cancer might be in a human environment. So Jessica hopes that this model can be used to find new treatments for this brain tumor.
And I mean, I feel like even just being able to grow a human-like brain from stem cells tissues is already like groundbreaking research that she's doing. And I'm sure a lot of other researchers can use that too. And I mean, hey, if she finds new treatments for this aggressive brain tumor, that's amazing.
Yeah, I think it has a lot of implications. Yeah. I think studying it for glioblastoma is a great starting point, but I can only imagine if this is a way to find a new treatment for glioblastoma that it will be taken up by.
Yeah, so much.
So many other people.
I'm actually going to, after this episode, look into that research because that's very fascinating.
Yeah. I remember meeting these two students and just like immediately upon like talking to them being like, maybe I should switch my research. Like, on the one hand, misophonia is something that I'm not going to self-diagnose myself with, but like I do get intense negative emotions for loud truck sounds. And so understanding that there's someone out there who's trying to make our experiences better is just like, thank you.
Yeah.
It's like I also made a friend who studies chronic pain, and I was just like, we need you on this planet right now. But just, it's insane that people are growing human brains.
Yeah, that's really cool and really crazy. And it's amazing what science can do. So shout out to those two PhD students doing some great work.
Yeah, exactly. Now into the episode.
All about ComSciCon Canada. That's a mouthful.
It is.
So, Julia, can you tell us what ComSciCon Can is?
Yes. So I actually found out about this workshop / organization through a workshop that was hosted at Dalhousie called Science Communication. And basically, there was two grad students who were involved with science communication efforts who put together a workshop and were just like telling us what is science communication, how can you get involved. And one of the ways to get involved was through this workshop.
Yeah.
So the original workshop was founded by grad students in the U.S. I know currently, or this year, it was being held in Boston, but I don't know exactly which university it came out of.
Okay.
And it's quite a competitive science communication workshop to train graduate students to communicate their science to not just their peers or other experts in the field, but also to the general public and to policymakers, etc. And so that's a highly competitive program.
Yeah.
It has about over 2,000 applications per year.
Oh, wow.
And they accept maybe 50 people.
Okay. And this is in Boston.
This is in Boston this year. So I applied to that with very little success. And the big kind of caveat of applying to ComSciCon is you have to have prior science communication, experience. And so I think this is a good thing because it encourages you to explore science communication first before you decide that it's something that you want to get into.
Yes.
But the people who successfully attended the Boston one are like outstanding science communicators. Anyways, so I also applied to ComSciCon Canada, which was founded about 5 years ago. And I was successful with this one, which I was very happy about. And so it was a 2.5 day long workshop hosted by grad students, and students all around Canada came together. We were at McMaster University in Hamilton, and we learned about various topics like data visualization, storytelling, science improv.
Wow.
I know, like lots of different topics. And we had a keynote speaker. So the keynote speaker was Dr. Alexander Hall, which is an assistant professor in science communication at McMaster University and a lead investigator for the Science and Society Lab. And so the keynote speaker was really incredible. He, I think, has been a part of several science communication initiatives in the UK and is now bringing it over to Canada.
Oh, that's awesome.
So, yeah. So, yeah, in a nutshell, it's basically a training workshop for science communication enthusiasts, and we have a whole whack load of different topics that we covered throughout the 2.5 days.
Yeah, and you're all coming from different scientific type backgrounds, right?
Yeah, that was like definitely one of the really cool aspects of it, is that it was like the first time in a long time that I was around not just health researchers. Yes. So yeah, and it was cool to get a grad student experience from not just Dalhousie University, but also UBC, Toronto, York, like it was just
kind of
a bunch of
everything and the differences and similarities.
Exactly.
And, yeah.
And you meet someone who does similar neuroscience research and you also are like, oh my
gosh. You're like, oh my gosh. I found the one other person.
Exactly. So it's quite exciting.
Oh, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So you kind of gave us a little bit of a brief overview of the program of this workshop, but can you kind of go more into detail, I guess?
Yes. So one of the first workshops was hosted by Carrie Boyce, who's an executive director of the Royal Canadian Institute for Science, or also called RCI Science. So it's a big program that's really dedicated to science communication efforts. Yeah. She did a workshop on evaluation. So it was all about the importance of evaluating the science communication work that you're doing so that you can see how it progresses over time. And no one loves this topic, but she did a great job at like telling the importance and making it entertaining. And what I mean by no one likes this topic is like, I don't know about you, but no one loves surveys. No one likes conducting them. No one really likes analyzing the data. Yeah. You know, it's just, it's a part that we have to do, and it's important to be told to do it.
Yes.
But it's not something that we, I don't know, I don't immediately, I'm like, oh, I like, really want to create an evaluation.
Conduct a survey.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it was a really neat workshop and really made me think about the importance of evaluation.
Yeah.
And, if you're out there, like, doing some initiatives, make sure that you evaluate it pre-workshop, post-workshop, and over time. It's really, really important.
And make sure if you're attending a workshop and they ask for feedback, you give it. Because I am guilty of not doing that. So now I know the importance and I will do it in the future.
Yeah, yeah. It is kind of a critical role to ensure that people are meeting the goals that they set for themselves, right? And then we also had a workshop on Indigenous connection hosted by one, I don't want to pronounce this incorrectly, but Wandi Wakita. And it was a really, really interesting session. We focused mostly on storytelling, and Wandi Wakita told us several stories that relate to how we need to be better science communicators. And you can make links between the importance of tradition, the importance of storytelling, understanding the difference between wisdom and education and language and everything, and how we can take those practices and keep them with us as we continue with our science communication efforts. So I really like this one. For the majority of it, I had my eyes closed and I felt like he was taking me to a whole different
universe.
Like a
journey.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
So it was really, really, really neat. I would highly encourage you to go seek out the works of Wandi. He's done like incredible things.
Wow.
Yeah. And then we had a workshop on data visualization, like I mentioned, by Natasha Vitkin.
That's an important one.
Yes, very important. So she is the knowledge translation lead at Designs That Sell. And basically, this is a science illustration company. So she has a lot of experience with just understanding the different techniques and tools that you can use to visualize your data. And she took us through like an example of like, this is where it started and this is where it ended up, you know?
Yeah.
And there's just like so many different ways you can use numbers, words, colors, and different graph types to get across a message.
Yeah.
And for anyone who is in research and hasn't explored data visualization, honestly, there's like lots of like online tutorials and stuff. Like I would highly encourage seeking it out. I don't know what your experience is.
Having a great visuals of your data makes it easier for you to explain it, makes it easier for your audience to understand it. And all around, it's just a lot easier of a presentation that you're doing when you have good visuals, and especially with data that can be really complex.
Yeah. And I'm sure, like you as a listener, you probably have seen lots of work that data visualization has like been a part of, whether that just be like a website that shows you COVID statistics or a poster. I don't really know of, I think COVID is the best example that I'll come up with on the spot, but it's not just used for traditional research papers, right? And a lot of it ties over to graphic design, which is really a cool connection between like math and science and art, which I really like. And at the end of the day, people look towards things that are pretty.
Yes.
You know?
They like the catchy things.
Exactly. And that's like one of the very strong methods to communicate your research is through catchy, flashy, and easy to understand visualizations. Yes. So the next kind of workshop that we did was Science Improv by Dr. Omura, who is a professor in physics, but is also has 20 years of experience doing public outreach, or even longer.
Okay.
And this one, I know Science Improv sounds really crazy, yeah. but honestly, best workshop, probably the highlight of my my time during CompSciCon Canada. It was just, it was so fun. But improv, you might think of it as being completely separate to science, but think about every single time you were asked to stand in front of a crowd and talk about your research.
Yeah.
Having improv skills is really important for thinking on the spot, not having control over the future, and having confidence in front of large crowds. So it is like, I think everyone should do it, to be honest.
So what, I'm very curious about this workshop. So like, what did it look like? What were you guys doing?
So we started off with like low risk activities where it's like in a big group, we all do storytelling where it's like, the person before you says a word and you say a word after the next person, whatever. So it gives you an idea of like interacting with the people around you and not having control over where the story goes, right? Yeah. And then we did some more moderate risk exercises where you're in groups of two or three. And my favorite one from this one was like, you had like an interviewer, like a reporter, and then the interviewee, and you're just talking about the big scientific discovery that they made.
Yeah.
And I was talking to someone whose discovery was that he found out that the world was going to end in 3.5 hours or something.
Oh, no.
Anyways, it was just really entertaining and, again, puts you on your feet.
Yeah.
Makes you, like, you have to work with both, like, laughing on the spot, but then also just, like, again, I can't lead the narrative. Yes. I don't know what the person is going to say, right?
Yeah.
And then it ended up with high risk where it's, like, you can volunteer to be like one of three people in front of a big crowd.
Yeah.
Right? And so I did.
Yeah.
Surprise. Surprise. Anyways, I was a part of a three-headed monster that was being interviewed about rocket propulsion. And so they would ask a question and then the three-headed monster would respond one word at a time.
Yeah.
It was very entertaining. I didn't realize that we could like make long sentences, and I was the last person of the three-headed monster. And so she'd be like, oh, how does rocket propulsion work? And then the first person said rockets, second person says go, and then I say fast.
Yeah.
And then it's like rockets go fast. And then anyways, I was the last person, so I was always making like three-worded sentences. Anyways, it was very, very entertaining, very comical. But yeah, so it really teaches you to have confidence in front of a large crowd, how to take things easily. And at the end of the day, it's important for science communicators to get their message across as clearly as possible. And it's important to have like truth and honesty in your work.
Yes.
But you have to learn to let go of your project, right? Like once it's out in the world, other people are going to interpret it in their own ways, right? Yeah. And so Science Improv kind of teaches you that lesson of, like, you only really have control over what you say, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And we do have a big responsibility with that, but you can't beat yourself up over
yeah.
what others do.
If someone takes something and goes with it and makes a whole false narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. So everything else in this conference was done in a panel. So we had education and outreach panels where we talked about science communication, like, different mm-hmm. ways. And Dr. Sean Hercules was one of the panelists, and they talked about their involvement with Science is a Drag, which is a drag show that merges science and drag queens.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I think it was a really good example of how science communication can extend beyond writing.
Yes.
And even, like, videos yeah. and, like, you know, nature documentaries yeah. and stuff, and bring together what you're passionate about and the science that you do.
Yeah.
And obviously it reaches diverse audiences, which is mm-hmm. what we want, right? It's like, I would say, primarily entertainment. Science is a Drag is primarily an entertainment yeah. show, but in the process you learn about science.
Yes, so
it's
exactly.
It's really great, and it's long time scientists, first time drag queens.
Oh, okay.
So
yeah.
all the performers, except for they have, like, some professional training with, like, long time performing drag queens, but all the performers in Science is a Drag are first time drag queens, but are also scientists.
Oh, that's fun.
So it's very cool. And then we also had a panelist, Anthony Morgan, who is the co-host of Nature of Things on CBC Television. So took over David Suzuki's role.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And they talked a lot about just being yourself and his journey through science communication, which is obviously a very interesting one because yeah. he's now on CBC.
Yes. So,
yeah. So we had a lot of other sort of panelists as well, but I don't want to go into super, super lengthy yes. yeah. descriptions. And then to not – here I am saying no lengthy descriptions, but I'm going to keep talking. We also had a workshop called Create-a-thon, where each person who was a part of the workshop had to create their own science communication piece, and then we had it expertly peer-reviewed.
Oh,
so someone nice. Who has science communication background
yeah.
peer-reviewed our pieces with the hopes that we'll publish it somewhere mm-hmm. in the world. So one really cool thing is one of the reviewers recognized me from being in Bamfield from 2016. Bamfield, great question, is a
why should I know this?
Science Marine Center on Vancouver Island like does science outreach programs for high school students. So when I was in grade 11, I attended, and this
that is
science
so funny.
Librarian, yeah, science librarian at McMaster University was also at Bamfield in 2016 yeah. and recognized me. So I was like, what? I was only there for 4 days,
yeah.
but I guess my face
hasn't
changed.
You left an impression.
I left an impression and my face hasn't changed. So, yeah. All in all, those were all the workshops. If any of that sounds really interesting to you, I highly encourage you to apply because probably the best workshop I've ever been to.
Wow, those are amazing reviews by yeah. Juliet Rowe.
Not sure if you want to go now, Teresa, yeah. but it's... yeah, I feel like I was rambling, and I could probably talk about it for hours.
I mean, it sounds like a great experience, and I think for any grad student. I wonder if, like, is there the Boston chapter and then the Canada chapter,
yeah.
or are there other smaller ones?
There's also other smaller ones.
Okay.
I'm not sure about the U.S. smaller branches, but I believe there's one in Quebec, and there's an Atlantic region, and there's probably one other smaller branch in Canada.
Yeah.
So if you apply and you don't get into Canada, there's also other smaller branches.
Yeah.
And from what I know, anyone who's attended any of these sort of workshops have, like, really, like, gained a lot out of
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's, like, one really is better than the other.
It's just...
I think it's mainly just length.
Yeah.
I think The Canada one is just a longer workshop.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And I wonder, I don't know if you know whether or not the smaller ones maybe accept people that maybe they've dabbled a little in science communication or they're interested in it, like gone to workshops or have some pieces, but it's not necessarily like out there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I wonder if people who are interested and want more confidence in it could maybe attend the smaller ones.
I think so. And just generally, like, I don't know what the, like, application, like, how many people apply are like, but I think the more you apply to, the higher your probability of getting in, is as well. And honestly, like, I do have science communication experience, but meeting the people who run these workshops, I feel like I have none, you know? Yeah. So I would just encourage anyone to apply.
Yeah, there's no loss in applying.
Exactly. And the application is fairly short and straightforward. It's just like a Google Forms thing. Most things have like character limits, so you don't even really write all that much.
Yeah. It's probably the simplest application you'll do in grad school.
Yeah, and there's no expectation for like academic abilities. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't have to provide your transcripts. You don't have to say how many scholarships you've won. Yeah. It's literally for people doing science communication.
Yeah. So that's nice.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, what is something new that you learned at this workshop and maybe something that surprised you?
Ah, great question. After I've gone over a lengthy overview of all the things that I've learned. So pretty straightforward. What surprised me was definitely the science improv. I have already kind of gone through it, so I won't go over it again. But I think anyone who just like thinks science is science wouldn't put those two together. And so very much surprised me, very much changed my way of thinking, very much big proponent of it. And for anyone listening, if you're a TA, I think you can like look up improv activities and stuff and use it as an icebreaker for your class. I think everyone would love it.
Yeah.
Except for like maybe one or two people, but that's fine. And then something new that I learned, I think that this kind of came up a little bit in last week's episode with Carly, but one of the biggest sort of lessons that came out of Dr. Sean Hercules and...
Great last name, by the way.
I know. And Anthony Morgan and Emma Davey, who I didn't introduce, but Emma Davey is a synthetic, inorganic, and organic chemist and did her PhD and Bachelor's of Science at the University of Victoria. So fellow University of Victorian. Anyways... All three of these individuals did the education and outreach panel, and they really, really focused on the importance of, like, being you. Mm. And I think it's, like, fairly straightforward to, like, be true to yourself.
Yes,
and
be authentic.
And everything. But they really showed you how to do this. Like, seeing Sean Hercules talk about science as a drag and how they were involved with drag and brought together science and this like passion was like, it was very inspiring.
Yeah.
And it was something that I learned. It's like being you doesn't only include like how you dress, how you interact with people, but it's like you can bring your passions outside of academia into academia and make them valuable. And then also Anthony Morgan talked a lot about like how, you know, people tend to say, like, oh, you need to grow up. You're an adult now. Mm-hmm. But he always refused to grow up. And that's, like, what makes him the actor-comedian that he is today. Like, it's like, you know, he still finds humor in things. He still finds time to laugh. Mm-hmm. And he still, like, does really ridiculous sort of things on TV or with other people. He has this one sort of program where he, like, will be, like, put your right hand up if you think it's okay to pee in the shower. Or I think it's not if you think it's okay, if people should pee in the shower.
Yeah.
And, like, left hand up if you think people should not. And then you're, like, what a provocative question, you know?
Yeah.
But the idea behind it is it's, like, not a debate. But if someone says something that surprises you, then you, or somebody says something that makes you laugh, then you have to switch to the other side. So you have like two groups of people who have their right and their left hands up.
See.
And then you have like a podium and you're saying things. And if someone says something that just surprises you,
you
walk to the other side. Yeah. And it's just like, that's a way to bring together like the importance of keeping an open mind, mm-hmm. which is really needed for science, and fun, you know?
Yeah.
So it's just like, I don't know. I really learned a lot from that just like panel discussion and how we can actually bring creativity into the work that we do. And that, I don't know, kind of motivated me to like the next time I go to a conference, not just wear like conference clothes.
Yeah.
Like obviously I'm going to dress professionally.
Yeah.
But like I feel awful in like a pantsuit.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like.
Yeah, you can wear, you really can show up as long as you're respectful, however you want, and that what's authentic to you. Mm-hmm. And also I feel like when you are just being yourself, you're going to be way more calm and relaxed. And if you're a presenter at a conference and you're like, I don't want to wear like this blazer thing, whatever, like I just want to wear like my slacks and like a sweater, go for it, because your presentation will be so much better because you'll be comfortable.
Yeah. And, you know, there are sometimes guidelines with like oral and poster presentations. But if a conference allows you to be creative, then mm-hmm. that's another place where you can show your own kind of work, like kind of break outside of the traditional works of what it means to be like a science presenter and like present things in your own ways. But obviously, like, talk to your supervisor before you go do something like completely outrageous or something, but
miming your research.
Yeah, exactly. Which, yeah, so really I think like the keynote speaker talked about how at a conference he was invited to, they actually had like a science comedy night where scientists went up and spoke as like stand-up comedians. So it's like things are changing.
Yeah,
you know, definitely. And so if you're a scientist who loves comedy,
scientists like to have fun too.
Exactly, exactly. So yeah, I think that's the biggest lesson that I learned and something that I will definitely take with me moving forward, because I don't know, I feel like everyone in academia was never like a normal child growing up.
Yeah.
Because like, what are we doing?
You know? Yeah.
So I feel like it is very true to almost every PhD master's student out there that there is some sort of personality thing that they could see flourish in other areas.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that can apply to anyone's job.
Yes.
You know, I mean, obviously there's like regulations in certain corporations, whatever, you have it. But you can have a fun, like dynamic job if you want it.
Yeah.
And you can, you know, make your work your own.
Exactly. And like you can actually have a personality, which is very cool.
Yeah.
Like we're not just all like lab robots.
It's not like we're like in the secret where no one knows that we go home at night and have other hobbies outside of work, you know?
But then at the same time, it's like you'll see someone. This is not really true in our lab, but I remember when I was working at BC Cancer, it's like you see someone outside of the work environment, you don't even recognize them.
Oh, yeah.
Anyways, that's what I hope to not achieve.
Yeah.
I want you to recognize me wherever I am, you know? So, yeah, I would say that would be the biggest lessons.
Yeah. And why do you think science communication is important?
Well, I think both you and I can answer this question. It's fairly straightforward. I think that, firstly, the information that we learned is not just information that should be kept between researchers.
Yeah.
And every sort of big development that you see in the world typically has some sort of research background. And so when you see people like accept and learn new things, then you can see the impact that it makes in the world, right? We just need to do the first step.
Yes, you just have to communicate it well and clearly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
To the world. But yeah, like think about the internet.
Yeah.
Phones.
And I even,
like airplanes.
And like the thing with even because we are health researchers essentially.
Yeah.
With health researchers, you know, if you're communicating your work, as long as it's like clear and out there, then that takes off some of the burden of like doctors and nurses and emergency rooms, because now people can go and they feel educated themselves to not diagnose, but to monitor whatever symptoms they might be having. Or, you know, you see on the back of ambulances, know the sign of stroke, and it's like written out like speech, like not exactly sure what all of them
are, but you know,
and it's like people can trust in themselves that they have the knowledge that scientists have given them or researchers have given them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not like people are smart, you know?
Well, that's
not like
the thing,
everyone's
right?
running around with their head cut off, like being like, ah, give me a doctor or a scientist or someone to tell me.
Well, yeah, that's the thing is like people are inherently curious.
Yeah.
Like we wouldn't be in the world that we are today if we weren't
curious
individuals.
At all, yeah.
Yeah. And we're always working to make a better world. And whether that's because you're in construction or you're in science or you're in music or whatever you're in, you're still like working towards something,
yeah.
right? And so every person in science has some sort of role to make sure that they are making, it doesn't need to be a big impact, mm-hmm. but an impact with the research that they're doing. And one of the ways they can do that is by actually communicating it in ways that make sense.
Yes.
You know?
And easily digestible ways that people can take with them.
Yeah. And let me just like put a note out there. That doesn't mean that every research is going to be good at this.
Yeah.
You know, so that's why we have people who do knowledge translation.
Yes.
You know, so we're not saying that every researcher out there has to participate, but science communication has to be a part of the process, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah. So. And like science communication is important and should be widely accepted, whether you're the one doing it or not.
Yeah.
I feel like.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think it's a pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Like, you talk to any person and they'll understand.
They'll be like, yeah, of course.
Yeah. And yeah. you could probably take out science from that and just call it communication.
Yeah. And communication's a skill, you know,
exactly.
like in general, whether it's science or anything else. So
yeah.
the more you do it and practice, the better you'll get at it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, Juliet, I was wondering, who do you think science communication is for and who is the intended target audience?
Okay, so we kind of answered
yeah.
this. I would say that obviously researchers have a role, but if you're not good at science communication, you have no desire to be a part of it, then knowledge translators are also really important.
Yeah.
Think about like a child novelist, right? Like
mm-hmm.
they're taking important things that we learn that are important for our children, the next generation, and they put it into visuals, into books,
yeah.
right? But the intended audience, in my perspective, so this is not the same for everyone,
yeah.
but it's A, for the ones who are there and want to listen, mm-hmm. and B, for the ones, the keynote speaker explained it perfectly well. It's like the wife or the partner of the anti-science person, you know. It's like we're not necessarily out there to convert people to science,
yes.
right? We're not out here spewing science propaganda, like
yeah.
or anything. Like people who've made up their minds and are like very anti-science, they don't want anything to do with it, they're not the target audience,
yeah.
at least for me. But they're sort of partners, family, friends,
people around them
who've only heard of their perspectives,
mm-hmm.
and who might not know any better. That's the target audience.
Yes.
Those are the people who we're like, well, let me tell you something new.
Yeah.
You know? And so that's why we have things like science comedy,
yeah.
science is a drag, you
mm-hmm.
know, like all these sort of initiatives that target the community that might not be keenly interested in it, but are also not keenly against it.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree. And I think this kind of goes back to our interview with Carly,
mm-hmm.
and how she mentioned that in high school, her chemistry teacher was talking about chemistry being like Lego,
yes.
like building blocks in Lego. And I think that type of science communication is so important because
yeah.
it ignites something in that individual being Carly.
Yeah.
And, you know, she went on and did all this research and
yeah.
now is working in an administrative role. So,
yeah.
It's, the impact can be as much as one individual, or it could be like, oops, sorry, as one individual, or it can be, you know, an entire, your keynote speaker of an entire workshop.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's, I don't know. It's very
yeah.
inspiring.
And it has a ripple effect. Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah.
And like, even if we think about the people who are listening to this podcast, hello, mm-hmm. anyone from ConSciCon Can
yes.
that I met, but obviously this isn't reaching the entire universe,
mm-hmm.
But there is a small subsection of people who like to listen to
yeah.
us. So hello to everyone. Love having you guys here.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what is your biggest takeaway from the conference?
Always a hard question to answer
yeah.
because I enjoyed every minute of every day. But I think my biggest takeaways, the people that I've met and the connections that I have made. It's just, well, firstly, I'm a very social individual.
Yes.
And I love going to school, surprisingly, I know, shocked. So the fact that school is a big part of my life and then getting to share it with other people who are in completely different, you know, fields,
yeah.
but have an equal amount of enthusiasm
and curiosity,
yeah. for what we do. You know, like, I'm in a university, but I don't interact with the astronomers and the physicists and, you know, everyone else in our university. Like, they mostly have their own lives. So to bring together all these people who are, like, super passionate about everything that they're doing, and then to just, like, meet with them and get to know them and get to know them outside of their research.
Yeah.
It's just, like...
Yeah.
You can't do better than that, honestly.
And I think the great thing about a conference like that is that, you know, if we were to go right now over to the physics department, I'm sure there'll be some people that like to talk to us, and there'll be others who are like, I don't want to talk to you.
Yeah.
But a conference like that, everyone is there to, you know, be engaged and communicate and learn and meet new people. So it's a great environment for that.
Yeah. And I don't think anyone went into the conference knowing other people, which I think it makes a big difference. And the ComSciCon Canada organizers did a fantastic job at making sure that you mingle with other people. So
oh,
it's just
great.
Like,
yeah.
unfortunately, I only got to talk to some people in really small chunks.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, it's just like, honestly, like, I had dinner with one person and I'm just like, I'm going to see you again. I know it for sure. Even though in the entire conference, all we did was have one dinner, you know? Or someone else, we had like a walking group one of the mornings. And it's just like, again, like, pretty much only interacted with them for that one morning walk.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I see them as being people that I will reach out to for advice or reach out to see what they're up to and like all these things. And I don't know. It's always so sad to make friends in other places and leave them. But it's also just like, people are so cool. You know? So definitely.
Yeah, definitely the exposure to different people doing different things and having different passions is – it's inspiring, I feel like. I feel like you came back inspired.
I did. Yeah. It's like when I watch a nature documentary and I'm just like, oh my gosh, there's so many animals in the world, you know? Except this time it's like there's so many cool people out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of animals, we usually like to end this podcast, Julia and I, with a personal either, you know, story or fact or something fun about our guests.
Yes.
Since we have Juliet here today, I know we already kind of talked about your cats, and I learned way more than I knew beyond Frank. So I'm not sure if you want to maybe
elaborate on the cat personality.
Yes.
Frank, everything.
Maybe your hopes for this new kitten.
Yes.
Do you get like a say in the name?
I don't think I do,
okay.
But I do have a list of names on my phone. I will share them with the world, so if anyone gets inspired by these cat names, they can feel inspired by them. I guess I have a avid love for cats, my future pet names. I think it'd be really cute to name a cat, or I guess any animal, Miso.
Oh, yes, that would be cute.
I also love the name Oliver.
Oh.
I don't know why. It's one of my favorite names. Bean, because
like a little bean.
It's just a little bean, you know? I also think Tofu is such a cute little name. And then I went through like a flower phase, so I think like Daisy and Rodo. Rodo for rhododendron. Also Chickpea. I think Chickpea's really cute. But my number one name and the next name of my next cat is going to be Kirk.
Kirk. Oh, that's a good name.
It's in reference not to Captain Kirk, but to Kirk the cat that's from Gilmore Girls, where Kirk gets a cat and names it Kirk.
Yes.
Yeah. So anyways.
That's funny.
Probably one of my favorite just like little bits in that show.
Yeah.
So I do really want to name a cat after Kirk, who named his cat after Kirk, you know? I think it's really funny. But yeah, I mean, I don't really know how it became such a fan of cats. My dad's whole family is obsessed with cats to like the same degree. My grandma, conveniently also named Juliet Rowe, has been a cat person her whole life.
Yeah.
My dad's three sisters, like all of their family photos, like
cats.
It's just them holding cats all the time. My dad has always been a fan of cats. I send him like daily photos of Frank.
Yeah.
So when I was a kid, I basically begged my parents for a cat. Mm. And one day it actually came true. And Dash is like, he was the funniest cat of all time. He was like, he was quite lazy. Like he would, sorry, by lazy, I mean, I'm taking that back. He wasn't like really that lazy, but he loved spending time around our family. He wasn't overly cuddly, but you could never go around the house without having him.
Mm-hmm. He liked to stay close by. Yeah.
He also liked to be high up. So he would find like a place on top of the fireplace and like look over everyone.
Yeah.
and he was just funny. I think the thing that made him funny was the fact that my entire family thought he was funny.
Yeah.
And we would like sit around in this circle that we called the Rowe family circle. Because we, like, unlike other families that have dinner at the same time, my dad always came home at a different time. And I honestly like am really impatient when it comes to food. So I would just like eat as soon as I got home, you know? And so instead we had a Rowe family circle where once everyone was home, we would all sit on these like couches that was a circular formation. And we would just talk about our day.
Yeah.
And then my cat would just be like in the
center.
You know, just like hanging out.
The heart of the family.
Yeah. And we would just sit there and like chat about him like as if he had nice. Like,
you know, as if,
I can imagine you doing the same with Kobe.
I ask Kobe things and like in my head he responds.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
I'll be like, should we go this way today? I'll be like, yeah, he wants to go this way. Yeah, let's go.
And like, he was so funny. Like, we would leave the doors open accidentally. I don't know how we managed to do that like several times, but he wouldn't go farther than just like the front porch. So sometimes you just see him sitting there.
You just be watching.
And the farthest he ever went was like to a neighbor's house, but you know, didn't really make it far. Like the back door was open for like 2 hours. My dad was doing some sort of construction project and just completely forgot that we had a cat, I guess. And I literally made it like 10 feet to our neighbor's house. So he was great. And then my cat in my undergrad, Vivaldi, she was feisty. She liked to sleep in sinks.
Interesting.
She made really weird sounds when you played instruments, because like everyone in my family knows how to play an instrument.
Yeah.
And so I'm gonna recreate it. So anyways, if you played like the violin, the piano, whatever, she'd be like, hey. Wait, no, hold on. That was really bad. She would do like, like she would like, it would
like match it.
But it was like a meow. So it was like, and it really did sound like that. Like it was such a funny, weird little sound. We're like, what is this sound?
What is going on?
But even though she was named after a composer, I don't think
she was that.
Music.
Yeah. So, she wasn't a fan.
Yeah. And me and my roommate, we would literally have like hour long discussions about her too, like on our floor. It's just like she made a huge impact, and now a family friend, or like it's kind of like a friend of a friend, takes care of her in Victoria, because she was a very, very anxious cat. Would have to, like, if we went to the vet, we'd put her on gabapentin.
Okay.
Anyways, a move across the country
would have been no-go.
No, she was just starting to get comfortable with me after, like, 3 years.
Yeah.
And she's now very, very happy. I get updates about her all the time, and it's, like, small little things. Like, she's starting to sit on my lap. She cuddles on my bed, you know? So her story has been, like, just years of improvement over time. And I am obviously sad to be apart from her, but knowing that she's in good hands
and is happy,
And then there's Frank, you know.
Yeah.
Last but not least, he's just the best.
And then the to-be-decided cat.
The to-be-decided cat, which I've heard is going to be a kitten of a Siberian cat.
Ooh.
I don't know if this is, like, going to happen.
Set.
I'm like manifesting it a little bit, but it should be like a similar size and hair to Frank, except like probably not all gray.
Yeah.
So that's exciting.
Yeah, that is exciting.
But yeah, my most updated Frank news is that he has really poor body awareness. Mm-hmm. And because of this, he rolled off my bed the other day.
Oh, no.
Just, like, completely just, like, was, like, lying on his back all happy and just, like, rolled
just
over.
Just got a little too close to the edge.
And straight onto the floor. He also once, like, was really interested with a candle that was, like, just open flame on the counter. And he burnt, like, some of his fur and like two of his whiskers. So I don't know how much Frank. That plays in his like body awareness yeah. now. But anyways, I just remember thinking he got yogurt on them because he usually sticks his head in like yogurt containers yes. and yeah. like eats them. But then I was just like, wait, why are these like
why are they all crispy?
Why are they crispy? Why does my hand smell like smoke? And then my roommate's like, yeah, like he got too close to the fire. I'm like, literally, how are you not like, scared? Like,
why are you that close, Frank?
So yeah, he's a really funny guy. Mm-hmm. I really like him. I'm gonna miss him a lot, yeah. but fingers crossed I'll be the go-to person to take
yes,
care of him. So
you will be the Frank sitter.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But that's all for me.
Well,
so
awesome. Thank you for talking to us about ComSciComm.
Yes.
Canada.
Canada. 2023.
Yeah. For any of those listeners who liked any or all of what Juliet talked about, go check out ComSciComm Canada, Boston, or, you know, one of the smaller Atlantic ones for 2024 and
yeah. apply. Yeah, and if you want to ask me questions about it, you can definitely feel free to reach out. You can find me on Twitter. Mm. I don't know if I'm okay to say Twitter, but, you know, I don't even know if DMing even happens on Twitter, but you can find me on Twitter at mindthegap, mind_the_g_a_p, mindthegap. Yeah. And yeah, I'll be happy to answer any of your questions.
Awesome.
All right. Thank you, Teresa.
Thank you.
Up next, we have recommendations with Cassidy Klein.
Hello, hello. Welcome back to Get Wrecked with Cass. Today I'm coming at you with a series of recommendations for some television shows and some things that I have been enjoying this summer. So first up, my recommendation is Beef, which is a television show on Netflix. It is complete chaos about two individuals caught in an unfortunate road rage incident who are absolutely not willing to let anything slide in between them. So it's a constant bicker and trickery between these two individuals, and it is absolutely hilarious. I definitely recommend that show. Secondly, I wanted to provide a recommendation for things to do in Halifax this summer. So first up, I have a boat cruise on the harbor. So this is a really fun activity that you can do with a group of friends, on your own, with your partner, whatever you choose. Essentially, you hop on one of the three ships down by Cable Wharf on the harbor, and you're going to do a 2-hour boat cruise listening to awesome music and having lots of fun. So definitely recommend checking that out.
Well, thank you for listening to our podcast, Mind the Gap. I am your host, Juliet.
And I am your co-host, Teresa.
And this was recorded at CKDU.